So our first session is introductory. We're going to talk about proteins. We're going to talk about some basics on protein structure. Many of the topics that we'll cover through the rest of the course have to do with looking at web pages and different types of informatics tools to understand protein structure and sequence. And so since some people at least are coming at this from an undergraduate point of view and may not have seen this in their classes yet, I want to sort of have a basic coverage of that. Unfortunately, my email address is spelled wrong. Thanks
to spell check. It should be MS State, but you all know my email address right now anyway. I'm
trained primarily as a physicist. Was my undergraduate training, and then my graduate training was in biophysics. And because of that, I wasn't trained, or I didn't come into this as a biologist. And being in a chemistry department, I generally think of proteins as being molecules, and I think about the molecular aspects of being protein of a protein, whereas somebody coming in from more of a biology point of view might say, well, this protein represents or corresponds to a gene that plays a larger role in a pathway. And certainly you need to be able to think about the gene aspects of what a protein is. But for the bioinformatics types of tools, they're usually thinking about the molecular and the chemical properties of these proteins. And so we sort of have to introduce that, talk about what protein structure is, talk about what the atoms in a protein do, and how those different atomic or functional groups give rise to the different molecular properties of protein. And so we often throw around different types of, representations of a protein, depending on how we want to think about them. So we can think about proteins at the sort of level of the amino acid. We can think about them as far as the organic chemistry type of representation, where we start thinking about functional groups. We can think about them as sort of cartoon structural representations. We can also think about them from a mechanistic point of view. What is this protein doing, and how does it fit into the other chemical reactions that are going on in the cell? And because proteins have this very broad array of ways of thinking about them, the computer software that we use to work with proteins has to be pretty versatile. And so some of the software programs will think of things as, sort of something coming in. You ever boot camp?
No, I was actually up from ITS. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Is the coding and everything working okay?
Yes.
Awesome.
Thank you. So the computer software has to be able to be versatile or at least specific in saying, this is the particular framework that we're thinking about proteins when we use this particular piece of software. And so, the purpose of this first session is sort of just to introduce some of those frameworks so that we all have sort of the same vocabulary as we work through the rest of the sessions. And so, again, we're going to try to, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but as you know, there's 20 amino acids, or maybe you didn't know that, but there are 20 amino acids. And basically, when we say amino acid, we're usually thinking about the side chains of a particular functional group. And so, there's 20 different, when we say 20 different amino acids, we really mean that there's 20 different side chains that you can think about in a natural cell. Now there are in actuality some more, but the 20s are the main side chains that show up in most biophysical and biochemical studies. And so if you're studying something that's a an unnatural amino acid or sort of one of these strange amino acids like norvaline or something like that, you're going to know that and you're going to recognize that that's an exception to the general rule. But generally we can classify these amino acids based on their chemical properties, right? And so you know, we have Lewis representation, we have ball and stick representations. You can see that all of them have the same sort of backbone, and that term will come up quite a bit, where you have a carbonyl or a COO type of a group, and then you have an amine. And I have here that this is the incorrect ionization. This might be correct in something like DMSO or maybe chloroform, but in water, these two are well, at least one and most likely both are going to be ionized, right? So amines have an NH3, a plus charge in solution, or an aqueous solution, and carboxylic acid groups have a negative charge in aqueous solution. And so, you know, even though I lifted this from a pretty helpful book called Molecules of Life, this actually shows up in a lot of biochemistry textbooks. It's kind of an annoyance to me, because the amino acids will never have that type of charge state in physiological conditions. But they all have the same backbone, and where they differ are the Lewis structures of what we call the side chains. And so what we've shown here is this is the subset of 20 amino acids that has relatively hydrophobic or you know, often greasy, you'll hear that, types of side chains. So lots of methyls, methylenes, generally not so many hydrophobic groups like, or hydrophilic groups like alcohols, or certainly no ionizable groups like the amine. So the only amine will be here in the backbone. And so, for example, phenylalanine is a very typical hydrophobic amino acid. It basically has a benzene ring and then a methylene, and so there's nothing there that really likes to be in water or be solvated by water. Glycine, you know, basically if you look at the backbone, it's a single proton. And you might say, well, how does that really qualify as a hydrophobic amino acid? It's just one atom. Whereas maybe I would think of a methyl group, CH3, as being something that doesn't like to be in water. And so that highlights the fact that there's some arbitrariness about this. You know, every group will have their own sort of vision of what hydrophobic versus hydrophilic amino acids are. This is the particular interpretation of the authors of Molecules of Life, so Dave Wimmer and a couple other folks. Generally, these are accepted, but there are times when you might find people disagree, and there are different ways of interpreting that. And lots of work back in the 60s was done trying to quantify what was, you know, how hydrophobic is this particular amino acid versus this particular amino acid. And so, for example, some of the early work by Mizaki and Tanford were looking at how much energy does it take to transfer a glycine from water into octanol versus phenylalanine. And so you can think about quantitative ways, but generally people sort of agree that these seven or I guess eight amino acids are generally hydrophobic. And so, you know, if they're hydrophobic, we can also think of polar or hydrophilic type of amino acids. You can see there's a lot more color on this slide because in addition to having methyls and methylenes, these ones will also have nitrogen, they'll have oxygen, they'll have some sulfurs in the backbone or in the side chain. And those hydrophobic groups are circled here again in red. And you can see, I mean, here's a nice alcohol and serine. You know, you have this amide type of a group in glutamine versus an asparagine. You have a thiol in cysteine. And again, these are polar, these are nice, and you know, they have a high polarity in their bonds, meaning that they're going to have a dipole moment that likes to interact with aqueous solvent, which, again, water is also has a high dipole moment. And these guys are, you know, you think of them as more hydrophilic in the sense that they like to be exposed to water, either because they like to make hydrogen bonds, either because they you know, have lots of polar bonds themselves and agree, and so you go back to that chemical principle, like dissolves like. And so the side chains here being relatively hydrophilic also means that, you know, they're generally going to be exposed or they're going to like to be in water. And then kicking that up a notch, we have, you know, these are also going to be polar, but these are also ionizable. So that in solution, you know, again, they have, or they will have a charge. And so this is by far the worst offender. When I said that I don't like the fact that they draw the backbone this way, right? Because this amine has a positive charge, and here this amine is still neutral. So, but it's the same chemistry. If this has a positive charge in solution, chances are this is going to have a positive charge in solution as well. But here you see that they have positive and negatively charged groups. The negatively charged groups are all carboxylic acids. So you have aspartate, glutamate. And then the positively charged groups, again, some of them, this one is, you know, they're all relatively different. This has an amine. This has a guanidino type of a group at the end of it. And so with this sort of delocalized charge, but a positive charge nonetheless. And this has an imidazole as the side chain. And so histidine histidine is kind of special in the sense that it's pKa, or that is the pH at which it becomes ionized or loses its ionization, is right around 6. And so that's close enough to neutral pH that the pKa of you know, the actual charge of histidine can be all over the place. And so, you know, oftentimes you'll find histidine is right in the active site of a particular you know, enzyme, because that you know, near neutral pKa means that pKa can shift depending on the chemical environment. However, you shouldn't rule it out. A friend of mine, you know, basically was doing a lot of mutagenesis and charge-charge interactions, and I think he was able to get a lysine to have a pKa of like 3.5, and so he was able to get very, very large pKa shifts by selectively changing the environments of the different amino acids. And so these are sort of a rough rule of thumb, but keep in mind that if you bury a lysine in the middle of a hydrophobic pocket, you know, it's not going to want to be charged, and so that's going to tend to shift the pKa away from 10.5. On the other hand, if you put a lysine right next to a carboxylic acid, that's going to make it want to be charged even more. It's going to shift the pKa in the opposite direction. So these are guidelines, they're rules of thumb. But the point here is that, you know, these different amino acids have different chemistries that allow them to sample different types of, you know, molecular forces. And if we make a chain of all these different types of amino acids, you can imagine that the types of the strategies and molecular forces involved in that chain can be very varied and diverse. And that's what gives us a lot of the diversity of life that we see, is that we can catalyze lots and lots of different types of chemical reactions using the different chemistry of the side chains themselves. We can think of you know, proteins, which we'll talk about the three-dimensional structure. You know, they will have certain amino acids that are on the surface. They'll have certain amino acids buried in the middle. But you can also think of, you know, what's the net charge or the net effect of all of those ionizable residues. And so the fact that you have some amino acids that are positively charged at neutral pH and some amino acids that are negatively charged, you can end up having a very interesting surface structure with patches of positive residues and patches of negative residues. Again, all of this can be modulated by the pH of solution. But the core point and the main thing that we'll talk about and the bioinformatics schools take advantage of is the fact that proteins are essentially polymers. They're heteropolymers in the sense that all the amino acids are generally different, but they're essentially, you put amino acids together and you end up with a long chain of amino acids. And so, you know, and the reason I haven't given you a mechanism here is because there's lots of mechanisms that you can imagine. Ultimately, this is carried out on the ribosome, right? So the ribosome is the functional entity in the cell responsible for making proteins. And so, you know, the actual mechanism of this is quite complex. that involves things like TRNAs and ATP and you know, elongation factors and all that sort of stuff that you might have covered in a biochemistry class. But when you put two of these things together, you can see that you can make a longer amino acid or a longer pair of amino acids. This would be called a dipeptide because there's two side chains. And they're connected by this sort of interesting bond consisting of a carbonyl group and an amide group, or this is called an amide bond. And that has some nice properties. One, it's neutral, and so it's not going to be so prone to changing its charge depending on the pH. But it also has some hydrogen bond donor properties as well as hydrogen bond acceptor properties. And then you can imagine just stacking this up longer and longer and making a chain of any kind of arbitrary length of these, each with having a different amino acid residue. So those R's are basically the side chains that we just talked about. And so, again, we have 2.5 days of 1.5 hour sessions approximately ahead of us. And so rather than try to talk at you for 1.5 hours the whole time, there'll still be a lot of talking. We're going to have some of these things where we can sort of hopefully get to know each other have some discussions in class. And so, I have a lot of these, and you'll see them peppered throughout the presentations. But now what I'd like you to do is, we've just talked a little bit about amino acids. Find the person next to you or somebody new sit and let's have a little bit of a, 2-3 minutes of, okay, what do you think the advantage of having these amino acids are? And then we'll come back you guys can talk to me for a little bit. So, discuss. I want to hear some talking. It's been too quiet in this room for me.
Hi.
I'm Nick.
We're just taking
four. Okay. We're taking a quick break so I can get you signed in. Name tag, signation, and let me give you a password too. Did you say what that was? This lecture you will be watching on one of the servers here. And so I gave you a username and passwords. That's what we're going to do. Your username should be just the same as your password. You should use just more. But on password is the first one that you have. So, and one of the first things that you have to do is the way you put together. If you show you can also.
Like I said, it's kind of hard to see secondary structures sometimes.
16 that has a solar panel on it, so we can have two 16s that are next to one another, they can reduce if you can have that solar panel launch.
Okay, so what'd you guys come up with?
Versatility.
Versatility, that's a great reason. So what do you, care to elaborate?
They can connect in just about any order. They just need the right sequence of bases to go from DNA to RNA to protein. They all use the same bond to link together in the primary structure. And you have several different non-polar, several polar. You have two different negative amino acids, two different positive amino acids. So even within groups, there's different amounts of pKa's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Anybody else want to add something else? I heard some discussion in the back.
They basically said a variety of structures, like he said, which will cause more interactions.
Uh-huh.
So I guess they describe it better.
And then we have things like with the cysteine, we have the thiol groups that can form disulfide bonds.
Mm-hmm.
So just different sort of interactions in that manner. And also that can lead to different structural motifs as well. Like with, like I said, I'm kind of putting the cart ahead of the horse here, but with beta sheets, you know, mm-hmm. for beta turns, you need certain things.
Yeah, and well, I think I don't know if that's right next, but we'll get to that pretty soon. Good. Yeah. So
20 different things. You could imagine if
the only molecule that you had to work with was something like polystyrene, where every single chemical group was exactly the same, it would be very hard to develop a functional enzyme from that kind of a molecule. And indeed, when you put polystyrene into some kind of solvent where it's soluble, it just behaves like a random chain. And so the fact that proteins can actually catalyze reactions and do interesting chemistry comes from largely the fact you have the versatility of 20 different amino acids.
And so you can sort of tune how things are going to behave under different circumstances.
Okay, so I'm going to switch to my remote to keep me from having to walk in. Okay, so we've talked about the protein backbone chemically, but now we can start thinking about other types of maybe taking a step up. So we're not quite 1,000 feet up, but maybe we've taken a step up from just looking at the single atoms. And so if we look at the protein backbone represented here as a ball and stick model. And so every one of these red is a carbonyl oxygen, so that's what we're basically making the transition from Lewis structure to something that's a little bit more three-dimensional. You can see that there's some patterning here. And so, we draw the Lewis structure and there's some patterning there too, but that's intentional in that it's a two-dimensional representation. When you think about the three-dimensional representation, though, there's patterning as well. And importantly, you can sort of see that there's a directionality. If I think about the order in which atoms appear, it's always N, C, C, N, C, C, where the different C's are different types. So the first C has a side chain sticking off of it. And I think this is just polyalanine. And I've been very selective about what protons or hydrogen atoms I've drawn. So I haven't drawn any hydrogen atoms on the side chains. But you can see the first carbon is a side chain carbon, or is associated with the side chain. The second carbon is associated with the peptide bond, the double bond to oxygen. And if I think about that order, it's just repeated over and over again. And because there's a specific order, that means looking at the chain going in this direction from left to right is different from looking at it from going the other direction from right to left. And so here, it would also be NCC, NCC, but the first carbon would be the one associated with the oxygen. The second one would be associated with the side chain. And that might seem like a finer point, but it does mean that I can represent this in a specific order. And typically, if somebody's going to give you an order of an amino acid or a peptide chain, they generally assume that they're going from the N-terminus, which is, I haven't drawn here, actually the N is closer to the terminus here, But the end terminus means, you know, starting here from the end C going to the side chain, followed by C going to the carboxylic group, to the C terminus, where again, eventually you would end up with a carboxylic acid, but it, just because it doesn't have a carboxylic acid, you're not shown a carboxylic acid, doesn't mean that you can't determine what's the N terminus and what's the C terminus. And this is a common thing that I give my undergrads in biochem class, is I give them a chain like this and tell them, is it going from N to C or C to N? And based on the order of atoms, you can tell. Now, we can think about the atoms being represented here, but really, all we really need to know if we're thinking about a protein structure is what are the amino acids, or what are the side chains that are of interest to us. And if we go back a couple slides and look at our list of side chains, you can see all of them have an ASP, a three-letter code, and they also all have a one-letter code, right? And so if I want to give you the atomic sequence of a particular protein, I don't have to give you all the atom information. All I really have to do is say, well, this is D, and it means aspartic acid, and it's followed by maybe K, and now you know exactly what atoms are in that protein sequence. Now, I say that, but of course you have to have the letter codes memorized, right? Or if you're a computer, you have to have a good lookup table. There's some tricks for memorizing these. Again, this is a one-week seminar. I'm not going to test you on whether you memorize it. I'd say that if you're doing this long enough, you will have to memorize. You don't have to sit there with note cards. Probably if you're studying for your MCAT, you do. But if you're working in the field, there's just no way that you can not know these, because you'll just see it over and over again. You'll, oh yeah, that's a glutamic acid versus that's a arginine versus that's a histidine. But some of these like aspartic acid with a D, you could think of that. Glutamic, the other one is that D is before E, and so D is shorter than E. One of my favorites is tryptophan is W, and so you can think of that as twiptophan. So there's some goofy ways to memorize some of these. But if you see it over and over enough, you'll become comfortable with it. And certainly, a lot of my students in the lab will have, either a printout of this, paste it up next to their desk. And just by the very process of looking back and forth a whole bunch of times, by the time they graduate, it's usually not a problem to go into their thesis and say, okay, draw the structure of histidine. And they can generally do it. So once I give you those one-letter codes, now all this stuff can be assumed. And so that's a useful property. But then you can also see that from the three-dimensional structure of this, there's also information in the backbone as far as what can be happening as far as hydrogen bonding and what is actually the chemistry of how does this backbone behave once it's put into aqueous medium. And so, here we have our peptide bond, just as another representation. And in particular, we talked about that peptide bond having a hydrogen bond donor and an acceptor. This is kind of unique in that the same chain can provide both. And so you can imagine there's different combinations of what can be a hydrogen bond donor and what can be a hydrogen bond acceptor, right? On the one hand, if you look within a single peptide bond unit, there's really no way for that sterically to happen, right? I mean, there's no way for this hydrogen bond to come back and point at that oxygen residue and do anything with the lone pairs of that CLO, or that CO. Similarly here, here we have four bonds. But still, this hydrogen bond vector, you can think of a hydrogen bond as normally forming this nice kind of, COHN type of a line. And again, these bonds simply just aren't flexible enough that you couldn't come back and form a hydrogen bond within the same amino acid even. So this would be within the same peptide, this would be within the same amino acid. But keeping in mind that a lot of these bonds in the backbone are sp3 hybridized, which means they're relatively flexible, you can bend around them. There are ways for a hydrogen bond to be made from one residue to the, I to I minus two, if you think about that. And there are definitely ways for once you put all of these degrees of freedom or bond flexibility in, there's definitely ways for there to be making a hydrogen bond between I and the O of the residue three back. And so we can do this, or we can do the I to I minus two. That's actually called a gamma term. Frequently observed as the beta term is I to I minus three. But within the same residue or within the same peptide, there's too much strain. So the backbone is kind of unique, and we can talk about different types of patterns that occur when you satisfy all the backbones in the protein. Yeah.
What does the I minus one and I minus two mean?
Right. So if I'm thinking about this being my alpha carbon, right? So this is the one where the side chain comes off, right? So this is I. This N is still, remember, going all the way back to our amino acid slide. We drew our amino acids as NC carboxyl. Right, so these three atoms, this NCC, are associated with one amino acid. So if I say this is amino acid or residue 4, that means that residue 4 encompasses everything from N to the C alpha and all the side chain atoms and the carbonyl carbon and the carbonyl oxygen. Right? And so now I can think of things as having a numerical index. So this would be, if this is 4, this would be 3. This would be 3. This would be 2. This would be, make sure I get my frame of reference right. This would be 1. This would be minus 1. And so here, again, if this is I, right, this guy is I minus 1. And then this guy would be I minus 2. And so it's just a way of indexing the amino acids. And we'll, I think you'll probably become a lot more comfortable once we start looking at PDB files and protein structures. That's a great question. All of these atoms we haven't talked about have names. So just like I call this the alpha carbon, this is usually called the carbonyl carbon, the carbonyl oxygen. And just because I can give you the whole sequence in a series of amino acid one-letter codes, doesn't mean that there aren't times when I want to refer to specific atoms specifically. Like I might say, the carbon delta or the delta carbon of some particular side chain. And that's just following because if this is alpha, then the second carbon is beta, gamma, delta, epsilon. So you got to know a little bit of Greek or at least have a good lookup table sitting there next to you. So that's what those indices mean. So you think of HI going to O, I minus 2. And if you just put the actual residue numbers in there, it should work out that way. I think these are all correct. So but if somebody finds an error, let me know. Okay, so we have potential for repeating hydrogen bond patterns in a particular backbone chain. And one of those common repeat elements is when we have, I don't know why I have gamma turns there. That might be a cruft from a previous lecture. But if we have HI going to OI minus 4, as drawn up here with the green arrows, this gives you a structure that if you put the protein in that particular conformation, you put the backbone chain in that particular conformation, it can be repeated indefinitely without any steric clash amongst the backbone or the side chains. Okay, so, and when you do that, we'll talk about phi and psi, but that's here for reference. But that's one way, if we want to satisfy all of the hydrogen bonds in the backbone, that's one way to do it. All right, think about taking our backbone and putting them into an apolar solvent. Right, so maybe the middle of a protein is sort of an approximation of an apolar solvent. Lots of hydrophobic groups in the middle there. Right? It's one thing to be hydrogen bonded to a nearby water molecule, But if you're going to take that backbone and put it into some, media like a cell membrane or an apolar solvent like the middle of a protein, you're going to want to maintain those hydrogen bonds. It takes energy to take a hydrophobic group and put it in the middle of a hydrophilic group, put it in the middle of a hydrophobic environment. Right? And so oftentimes we want our backbone to be hydrogen bonded, and if the only thing around that can satisfy those hydrogen bonds is the backbone itself, we want to understand how that can happen. And so this is one way where the backbone itself can satisfy all the hydrogen bonds that we need to. We can talk about turns being another way to satisfy hydrogen bonds, and so we emphasized this a few slides ago and showing you have a gamma turn or a beta turn here, but I haven't drawn what the structure looks like. If I actually make that hydrogen bond work, so I put a hydrogen bond between this NH and the CO, you can see what happens is it reverses the chain direction. So if this is N-terminus going to C-terminus, and it's first going up, then after the turn, it's now going back down. And so satisfying the hydrogen bonds in the protein backbone makes different conformations appear, some of which can be repeated indefinitely, some of which can't be repeated indefinitely, at least not very easily. And so, but they all have an effect on what is happening, on the macro level to the backbone. How is the backbone behaving? Is it going in the same direction? Is it reversing direction and doing something else? And so that's how we're going to visualize, what's going on with protein structure. And so we're sort of, again, we started with the amino acid level, but clearly proteins aren't just random chains of amino acids in solution. They have to adopt particular conformations if they're going to do the chemistry that they want to do. What does a helix look like? Well, this is how a beta turn looks like. This is how a helix looks. So when I take and I make all of those hydrogen bonds, again, all of these hydrogen bonds here, and I put the chain in that particular orientation, I end up with something that looks like a helix. And you can see that it's sort of going out of the board here, back into the board, and it's wrapping around and around. And importantly, you can see that there's hydrogen bonds being those hydrogen bonds, that hydrogen bond, that hydrogen bond. Okay, so I don't think I put that up this year. I don't think we haven't talked about pymol yet anyway. But you can see that this particular orientation makes the chain a little bit more compact. So it's this is the same number of residues as what I showed you here. So the chain is a little bit more compact. Now all of the hydrogen bonds are satisfied by the chain itself, and it wraps around in a right-handed type of a circle, okay? Another way that we can satisfy hydrogen bonding in the chain is by using the idea of a beta sheet, okay? And so in here, in the first chain, all of the hydrogen bonds were satisfied locally. They were satisfied within the chain itself, plus or minus 3 residues or so. Here, these two chains could be from entirely different protein molecules, or one could be maybe residues 1 through 10, and this could be residue 50 through 60. So there's no limitation on a beta sheet that those residues are anywhere near each other. And so they can be called, they're often called non-local hydrogen bonds. And you can see that if I take two of these and line them up with one another, it's still possible for me to satisfy all those hydrogen bonds. Now there's still some that aren't satisfied here on the ends, but all these hydrogen bonds on the inside of the beta sheet are satisfied by this additional strand of peptide. I can't really give you a hydrogen bonding formula, right? So in an alpha helix, I can say, H goes to I minus 4 or something like that. Because of the fact that these are non-local, there's no formula that I can give you to say this satisfies or this is what a beta strand or a beta sheet looks like. In this case, what I've shown you is parallel beta sheet. because, again, it starts out at the N-terminus, and if you look at the order of atoms, N, C-alpha, or side chain C, and then carbonyl C, N, C-alpha, carbonyl C, N, C-alpha. So again, that's going in the N-C direction. This is also going in the N-C direction. Right? So these two going in the same direction, both going left to right, means that this is a parallel beta sheet. Here, I've drawn one going from N to C on the top, and the other one going from C to N, or right to left, on the bottom. And you can see that there's also a way or a strategy to satisfy all the internal hydrogen bonds here. Again, these could be just as non-local. Again, there's no specified hydrogen bonding formula. This could be 10 residues away, it could be 100 residues away. But by orienting the chains like this and putting the backbone in the appropriate conformation, you can then still satisfy all of the hydrogen bonds. So this is called an anti-parallel beta sheet. Okay, so we've been focusing on how to satisfy the hydrogen bonds in the backbone, building our way up towards understanding protein structure. And occasionally I've given you, phis and psi angles without much explanation for what that means. Okay, so now we gotta understand what's going on. And sadly, I left my model kit up in my office. But what we'll see here is, if this is our backbone, so these are our backbone atoms, N, C, C, N, each of these bonds, as a single bond, as you probably learned in Chem 1, has a rotatable bond angle, right? So I can twist without much energetic input our amino acid or our bond around this bond or this bond. I can twist it around this bond. In principle, I can twist it around this single bond as well. This is basically what we learn about in organic chemistry. You have methyl groups that can spin very freely around sp3 hybridized bonds. But you do have some energetic considerations, and so you have those eclipse, gauche, gauche plus, all that stuff that you probably hated in organic. It comes back to haunt you here in biochemistry. And chemists love to name things. You all either love or hate the IUPAC, but the IUPAC has given names to all of these angles. And in this particular case, you could think of this particular bond angle being called phi, this one is called psi, and then this one is called omega. And this is nice because oftentimes we're thinking about, like, for example, I have to think about the phi value of resin 4. So this, the fact that there's a naming convention here is a nice, it makes it nice to talk about protein structure. It is one more thing you sort of have to memorize. But here, again, I sort of look at a phi as an O with a line through it. And so I think of that being, this one doesn't have oxygen on it, whereas the psi doesn't have an O with a line through it. And so that one represents the one with the oxygen. And so that's a simple trick that I've used to remember this. We'll talk about this maybe briefly, but you can see again, this C-alpha bond, or this C-alpha atom, has four different atoms coming off of it. It has a proton, it has another carbon, it has the side chain, and also has an N. So again, going back to your organic chemistry, that's a chiral atom. And chirality does occasionally come up in biochemistry, although not really that often, because all amino acids pretty much have a fixed chirality and it doesn't really change. And when you start making chains out of this, so now we're working on understanding how this fits together. Each of these phis and psis have a particular orientation, and you can imagine them contributing to the direction at which a chain goes through, goes through space. And so a conformation like this is going to have a very different set of phi and psi values. In particular, phi is -60, psi is -40, than parallel or an anti-parallel bank sheet, which basically stretches the chain out lengthwise. And in particular, this has an average psi of minus 120 and an average psi of plus 120, with large variations. So for helix, there's really only a handful of angles that will do it. With sheet, there's a lot of options. Now, why haven't I talked about omega? And so that's a great question. How many of you know the answer to that? Okay, one, two, maybe? Okay. I'm going to be teaching here in the fall, and I better figure out how to put this screen up without shutting the whole system down, but I'm not going to worry about it today. So the simple undergraduate answer, if I have a peptide bond, and that's, you can't see, and I'll try to keep it over on this side so you guys can all see it. Let's okay, so here's my peptide bond. And as I've drawn it, you know, this is a single bond, and again, that would be phi. This is a single bond, that would be psi. And as single bonds, they're sp3 hybridized. That means there's not a particular orientation that's favored for rotating around that bond angle. As I've drawn it here, you would think that there would be a similar type of restriction here for the CN bond. Unfortunately, remember, N is a fairly polar and electrophilic type of an atom. O is also a fairly polar electrophilic type of an atom. And again, the typical undergraduate way of representing this is that you can draw a resonance structure here where N has a partial positive charge and O has a negative charge, and therefore the electrons are sort of delocalized through here, which would, you know, make this have some double bond character. And if you recall again from organic chemistry, you can't rotate freely about a double bond. And so that means that this system of four atoms, I mean actually more than four atoms, but about this bond length, these four atoms, H, N, and C, O, are basically held to be in the same plane. Okay, and so while there's relatively free rotation around phi and psi, omega is fixed to be either 0 or 180. So it's either going to be like this or it's going to be like that. Now, again, that's the undergraduate biochemistry answer. The real answer is more has to do with things like hyperconjugation and electron delocalization. And so if you draw the pi orbitals here, you can see that there's some ability for those orbitals to overlap, and essentially you get the same answer for a slightly different reason. So those electrons like to be in a conformation where there's pi orbital overlap so that they can delocalize and hyperconjugate, and that will also give this sort of double bond character and make it harder to rotate around that bond. Okay, so when we think about rotation around phi and psi, and not having rotation around omega, that means that all these atoms here in this blue box are constrained more or less to be in the same plane. So the alpha carbon, the N, the carbonyl carbon, and the previous alpha carbon, as well as the hydrogen and the oxygen, all of those are going to roughly fall in the same plane. It's not perfect. You know, I told you it's going to be about 180 degrees. It actually ends up being about 180 plus or minus 10. But to a very good approximation, you can sort of ignore the torsion angle of this omega bond. And this would be the physical reason why. And that actually simplifies things tremendously for us. If you couldn't do that, probably a lot of protein structure would still be under development, because making that simplification of a planar peptide bond, makes it possible to do a lot of the structural analysis that we're going to talk about when we think about computational tools. This was first identified or first noticed by Linus Pauling, so a very famous Nobel Prize-winning chemist. And from this information, Linus Pauling was able to predict the existence of both the alpha helix and the beta sheet before any protein structures were ever determined. So you can imagine that this simplification and the fact that you assume that the hydrogen bonding in the backbone has to be satisfied really only gives you mathematically a couple of possibilities for doing that. And Linus Pauling was able to enumerate the two major backbone conformations that are found in actual protein structures. And so it was a huge boon when they started actually solving protein structures and seeing these particular combinations of the backbone torsion angles. What you can also do, though, and this is sort of related, we can think about phi as an angle. It goes from minus 180 to plus 180. Psi is also an angle. And if we leave omega fixed, like I just told you what we can do, well, that means that there's going to be a certain number of conformations that cause the backbone to clash back in on itself. And here would be a great time for me to have my model. Maybe I'll go up during the break and grab them so you guys can play with them. But if I put my phi and psi angles in a certain conformation, what happens is that those atoms form steric clash, and then that's not allowed conformation. So not only do we eliminate all sort of possibilities for omega, but there's really only a handful of combinations of phi and psi that give us local chains that do not have steric clash. Now you can imagine if I have a chain of 50, well then there's going to be of course some angles that cause steric clash, and that's going to be a big mess. But this is for like 2-3 residues. And again, back in the 60s, a guy named G.N. Ramachandran, and what I presume is an army of Indian scientists, sat there and iterated. They took basically a 3-residue amino acid peptide, and they said, okay, well, what if that central amino acid has a phi of minus 170 and plus 170, so somewhere up here. They can calculate the distances between all the atoms, and using some very hard sphere approximations, they say, okay, an atom is about 1.5 angstroms in diameter. They can say, okay, well, is there a steric clash? And so they can calculate, okay, minus 170, plus 170, there's no steric clash. Then they can go and they can say, okay, minus 160 plus 170, is there a steric clash? Well, there's no steric clash there. Minus 150 plus 170. And they keep doing that iteratively. Again, this was back before we had really convenient computers. And they can determine all the combinations of phi and psi for a small tripeptide that are sterically allowable. And of course, if it applies for a tripeptide, it's going to apply for 150, 200 amino acids as well. And so that's the orientation of what are the origins of what's called the Ramachandran plot. And when you do that, you end up with several regions that are sterically allowed, along with a lot of regions that aren't sterically allowed, right? So if I try to say, phi equals 0, psi equals 0, well, then there's some kind of steric clash. It actually turns out there's multiple steric clashes that prevent you from doing this. But if I go from phi equals 0, phi equals minus 60, psi equals minus 40, well, that puts me right in here where the alpha helical region forms. And so these are labeled based on the secondary structures that we'll talk about, but the structures that we've talked about, beta strand, alpha helix. It turns out that depending on the size of the protons that you use, you can actually get a little bit of a gap region to appear in here. And there's actually a very small region that if the chain is positioned just right, you can pick up down here. We'll look at that in the next slide. But what the main point here is that the colored areas on this Ramachandran plot of phi and psi represent areas that are sterically allowable, and the white areas are white because they're not sterically allowable. There's a clash between atoms. Okay, and that's something that I think is made a little bit more clear. So this is a figure out of my PhD thesis. And I can't take full credit for this. The original idea for this came from one of my heroes, Janet Richardson. But you can see this is the Ramachandran plot again. And here I sort of flipped it. So here, the white regions are the regions that are sterically allowable. And the colored regions are not sterically allowable. And they correspond to the different atoms that clash. And so I told you that there are multiple reasons why you can't set phi equals 0, psi equals 0. And that's because an oxygen clashes with an N. Looks like there's some purple, so that's an oxygen clash with a C. The bright red is a carbon and an H. So these are all labeled around the central residue, which is number 2. And you know, there's some naming conventions here that I'm not going to get into. But you can see that the shape of the white is dependent on the colors that give you different steric clash. And depending on the atoms that clash, they each carve out different regions of the Ramachandran plot. And so this is a way that sort of really hammers home what the Ramachandran plot represents. And here you can see that tiny little region down on the left-hand side that occasionally pops up. Anyway. Now we're talking about, you know, thinking about computational tools. This was clearly a computational approach that gave us the Ramachandran plot. The question is, how useful is it? Well, one can argue about fine details, but here are some actual phi psi torsion angles from protein structures where the structure has been solved. And you can see that by and large, you know, there's a few outliers here, but by and large, the phi psi angles in actual proteins line up very well with what's the predicted values from this very simple approach from the 1960s using hard spheres as atoms. And in fact, you know, one of the tools that we'll look at when we talk about the protein data bank is, you know, they use this as a means of assessing protein structures. So if there's a lot of outliers or a lot of phi psi angles that don't fall within the requisite, you know, recommendations, you know, that sort of flags that structure. Maybe there's some questionable things about this. Okay, so here's a question. Again, probably not one that you've talked about before, but you know, turn to your neighbor and we'll spend a couple minutes and discuss, you know, why might you see violations of the Ramachandran plot. So what might be a physical reason for seeing some of these atoms over here on the other side of the where they're not supposed to be? I want to hear some conversation. Thomas, do they have Shipley Donuts in Huntsville?
Do they have what?
Do they have Shipley Donuts in Huntsville? I don't know.
No, no. Really
not.
Is there a
bacon? Yep. Yeah, Krispy Kreme. Yeah, Krispy Kreme. Pretty good too. Okay, so what did you guys come up with? Anything?
Maybe there are stronger bonds within, like, tertiary structures that are more favorable than the normal natural steerings of.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So one reason, you know, we've drawn these as nice, you know, rigid bonds and rigid bond angles, but you know, in some sense these are averages, right? And so, you know, you all learn about the bond angle in a tetrahedral configurations being 109.5. But that can change. I mean, it can go to, you know, 107, it can go, you know, it's probably not going to be 7. But it's going to be around 109.5, and so there's a range of values that it can sample. And you can imagine if you start tweaking the structure, you're going to see things where maybe something that was sterically clashing before isn't sterically clashing now. And so you know, the energetics of the situation have a lot. And so we've made some very simple approximations here. But simple approximations occasionally break down. And so, for example, if there's a phenolalanine that really wants to get into a hydrophobic pocket, you can imagine that might torque on the rest of the structure a little bit and perhaps violate some of these Ramachandran principles. Anything else? Flor, I heard you mention something about glycine.
Oh, I was like, if there's a turn, I guess, like with a glycine or proline, and then
mm-hmm.
there's proline being sneaky and big and
amino,
so.
Well, so proline actually makes it a little less favorable. But a glycine, remember there's one less atom in glycine. Mm-hmm. And so the Ramachandran plot looks like this, so I really didn't mention it, but this is sort of the Ramachandran plot for alanine. In glycine, you know, that central carbon is no longer is no longer chiral,
yeah.
And this becomes a mirror image around the origin. And so now you can do all sorts of things on this side with glycine that you couldn't do before with having alanine. Right? And so
the percent composition, I guess.
Yeah, so if something has a high percent of glycine or there's a glycine in a particular phi side that you're looking at that seems to be odd, you know, that probably means that it doesn't have that particular limitation. It's always good to go, and if you're looking at a structure, you know, there are ways within the PDB to look at the phi psi distribution, you know, to check those residues out. You know, what's going on there? If you're going to make a real big stink in a research article, or your project involves studying this particular residue, and it has a very different phi psi than what you might expect, that could be telling you that something very interesting is going on there. Or if there's no reason for that residue to be out of place, then that might say, well, maybe I need to go look for a different structure and see if this holds up over multiple different experimental data sets. Okay, so the final thing that we're going to talk about here in this first session is the hierarchy of structure. It's come up a couple of times already, probably just because I couldn't help but mention it. But this is where you think about primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary structure. This idea was first proposed by a guy named Kai Ulrich Linderston Lang in the Netherlands. Someday I'm going to get to Europe and visit this place. This is Carlsberg Lab. It's basically a landmark of modern biochemistry. Sorensen was there. He developed a concept of pH. Linderston Lang was there, who developed, you know, primary, secondary, hierarchical arrangement of protein structure. Fred Richards was there, and he basically developed, using hard spheres to calculate accessible surface areas of proteins. And what's interesting about this place is that, you know, during the time that all of these people were active in doing research there, it was a brewery, right? So they were basically doing biochemistry, very, very good groundbreaking biochemistry, in order to understand how to brew beer better. And so that's a useful, I think, thing to remember when you're in the thick of doing biochemistry research is that, you know, lots of people are interested in biochemistry, and just because you're, you know, looking at something, you know, very molecular doesn't mean that it's not, you know, relatable to something very practical. Now, I don't believe the Carlsberg Lab still has its high-impact research program today, but I believe it is still open, and like I said, I'm hoping to get there at some point, just because of the number of great scientists that were there. I'm sure there is. Anyway, so Linderson Lang, he's kind of an interesting guy. He has an interesting sense of humor. If you Google him, you will find an article that he wrote on determining the sex of a fruit fly, and it was written in jest. But some of the approaches that he used for determining the sex was he would put a big mirrored screen, and all the women fruit flies would stop and check themselves in the mirrors. And the male fruit flies would just fly on through, and go. And so that would be one way. And then his description of the Schrodinger equation of the fly was H fly equals E fly, which again, if you're in quantum mechanics, is, you know, Robert gets it. He has a good sense of humor too. So I think that's another thing that we can learn from. Is that, you know, we can be very serious about our science and still have a pretty good sense of humor about it. Okay, so what was the hierarchy of protein structure? Well, again, probably many of you have seen this before. When we think of primary structure, it's basically a way of conceptualizing how proteins are structured. The simplest way, and perhaps the most basic way that you can imagine it, is simply the sequence of amino acids. So the chemical bonds. You know, if I'm talking about alanine versus glycine versus leucine, you can draw bonds for that, right? And so that's what I've sort of drawn here is a simple chain where I have, I think, four amino acids, and so I have a phenylalanine, lysine, histidine, isoleucine. You can draw that. And in some sense, this is the main structure that chemists need to worry about, right? It's if you know the primary structure, somehow the molecular forces are all predetermined to determine what else the protein is going to do. And so if you think about what Mother Nature has to work with, this is what Mother Nature has to work with. But we're not Mother Nature. We're far, far from it. So we need other ways to conceptualize what's going on here. So the primary structure is very useful. I can give it to you in terms of atomic structure. I can give it to you in a list of amino acids. But I can also talk about secondary structure, which is basically how the hydrogen bonding in the backbone is occurring. Right? And so and this is often abbreviated as things like alpha helices and beta strands. I would also include turns in that, although, you know, your mileage may vary. Always check with your biochemistry teacher if there's going to be an exam. But for me, secondary structure, and I think to Linderson Lang, secondary structure had more to do with the backbone hydrogen bonding pattern in the protein or peptide itself. And that's going to give you information about, you know, the atomic positions. But realistically, you can think of this as being secondary from the three-dimensional structure, right? So I could give you a list of one-letter amino acid codes, and I could tell you that the first four amino acids are in a helix conformation, and the second 10 amino acids are forming a beta strand with, you know, amino acids, you know, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. And you would know what the hydrogen bonding in the backbone is doing, but you wouldn't necessarily know what the three-dimensional structure of the protein is. And so in that sense, secondary structure can be distinguished from understanding what the actual, you know, structure, physical structure of the protein is. And in particular, again, looking at the drawings, we can, you know, represent these in cartoon diagrams, and this will come up in Pymol as well. But I can't necessarily tell you what the structure is, right? So if I tell you that there's a secondary structure there, a beta sheet, another secondary beta sheet here, and it's connected by an alpha helix. That would be a valid description of secondary structure, but it wouldn't have anything to do with the actual protein structure, which is what I've shown up top. And so, in that sense, tertiary structure is the actual three-dimensional structure of the protein. And of course, it encompasses things like the secondary structure, the beta sheets, the hydrogen, the alpha helices, and whatnot. But it also incorporates the three-dimensional position of loops and other things that don't necessarily have a regular hydrogen bonding pattern. And then our quaternary structure is just an extension where now we're involving multiple chains. And so we're still thinking about three-dimensional positions of atoms, but in this case, this is hemoglobin, I believe, yep. And I've drawn the A chains in pink and the B chains in blue, and so you can see that there's multiple chains going on here. And again, hopefully you'll learn how to make some figures like this when you start talking about pi math. Okay, final think and discuss question. We'll do this one quick because it's just about out of time. So sit and talk with your neighbors and we'll come back in a minute or two. Okay, what do you guys think?
It really depends on what you need.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Primary structure is important in that that's what the protein starts out as, and every form it takes after that is dependent upon the primary structure. However, if you're concerned with what it does, what its role is, tertiary and quaternary structure would be more important because you've heard of introns, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, protein version of that would be intine. Things that are cut out of
yep.
the protein final product.
So yeah, I think but I don't know that you would say intines versus exines. That's the word. But normally those types of non-expressed sequences of protein would not normally be included in the primary structure. So primary structure would only include what was expressed, and so you wouldn't have to worry about introns versus exons types of stuff.
Right.
But I. Go ahead.
I was just talking about the intine again because I think that is actually translated, but after protein, but I think it might be part of
processed. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, but you're right. I think it sort of depends. It's very context dependent. Did you guys have something to say?
Yeah, it was kind of along the same lines. Like I was saying, primary structure would be present in mostly anything, whereas a quaternary you wouldn't necessarily have unless you were looking at a dimer or a tetramer or something with multiple subunits.
That also depends on what you're doing. So say if you were just like checking for conservation of certain residues, then you'd be more interested in the primary structure.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're doing some sort of bioinformatics project, or if It depends on what you're working on.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think those are great points. When Richards, when Linderson Lang proposed this, he didn't mean to say that this is primary in importance. He meant it's primary in organization. And so there are times when you're thinking about organizational abilities that, it's really important to just know the sequence, and that's all you need to know. But if you're trying to model how an enzyme works, you're going to want to really know where the atoms are, at least as best you can. Okay, so that's pretty much our first session. I like to end with a little bit of summary. I know it's a long session. We'll talk more about some of the actual tools that you can use to do some of this in real life in the next session. But proteins, amino acids, important, yay. The chemical structure has sort of three-dimensional structural consequences, and that's where you can start thinking about hydrogen bonding and orientation of atoms. And then finally, we have this idea of hierarchical structure, where you can think about different ways of viewing, and that's important to note again, because many of the biological tools that we'll talk about think about proteins in a slightly different way, and so like a bioinformatics approach, as Thomas mentioned, might just care about the sequence of amino acids, where if you're trying to find similar proteins based on structure, well, that you're going to need the three-dimensional position of everything. Okay, so we got time. Generally, I like to break these up with sort of 10-minute breaks. It's pretty informal. I think there's plenty of coffee and probably a few donuts back there, too. And so enjoy, and we'll pick it up here in about 10 minutes.
What? Oh.